This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving. And we have a lot to be thankful for, too. We're celebrating our 33rd anniversary today with some of our listeners' favorite segments. Thank you to everyone who voted. A bit later, Nobel laureate Carolyn Bertozzi talks about her approach to chemistry, and we'll take a trip to the last days of the dinosaurs. But first, someone who's been on the program many times over the years is actor and science communicator Alan Alda. In 2018, he joined us just after he first publicly discussed his Parkinson's disease diagnosis. He joined us to talk about his life since then, how science informs his perspective on his condition, and what keeps him hopeful about the future. Have a listen. Alan Alda has had many roles in life, on stage, television, and in the movies, more recently as a teacher of communication at the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. And this week, he stepped into a new role as a public figure diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Alan Alda is a friend of the show. He's also here to talk about it. He's got a new podcast, Clear Plus Vivid. Welcome back to Science Friday.
The plus sign is supposed to mean and.
Oh, and. Yeah, I'm such a nerd. I look at the plus sign and I say it's a plus.
Yeah, well, it's clear and vivid, and I love it. I'm having such a good time. I'm interviewing such wonderful people. And just in the course, in the middle of all of that, I've been talking on television a few times lately about Clear and Vivid to let people know that the podcast exists. And I noticed my thumb twitching a little bit. And I thought, it's clear that I got some neurological thing here. So I, after 3.5 years of, it was 3.5 years ago that I was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see any reason to talk about it. But now I want to make sure that if it's talked about, that I can get the story out my own way, which is a positive way. I'm a little concerned, and I can tell what the culture thinks about Parkinson's because I hear it mm-hmm. coming, and I have a special ear open for it, and I feel very, very strongly that it's not a good idea to assume if somebody that you know gets, or if you get a diagnosis of Parkinson, it's not a good idea to think, oh, that's it, everything is over. And that's what a lot of people think. Oh, my God, oh, I'm so sad, that's so terrible. And then they're thinking of the worst case scenario. And most people, or many people anyway, I don't know what the figures are, but many, many people have years to go. And it's a progressive disease, but you can slow the progress. It doesn't go right to the worst possible outcome. And if you don't get it early, if you're in fear of talking about it or acting on it or, declaring to another person, like someone who can give you physical therapy and that kind, or maybe a group that you have to go to where you're in a room full of people and you're kind of opening up on that part of your life. If you postpone because of that, because of the cultural bias against Parkinson's, then I think it's not a good idea. You don't slow down the progress, and it's not the end of everything for most people, I think. Now, that's not to say that there aren't families suffering with severe cases of Parkinson's, and that's painful. Mm-hmm. But that picture doesn't have to be the one that guides us when you get a diagnosis.
Mm. Well, you said that you've had it 3.5 years. Why now talk about it?
Well, as I said, I started to see my thumb twitch on television. And I figured it was only a matter of time before somebody puts out a sad story about me, you know. And I think it's much more important to get out a story. Here's a guy who's been living with it for 3.5 years. I've acted during that time. I get up in front of audiences and give talks. I'm helping with the Alda Center for Communicating Science. I'm doing my podcast. I'm having the best time. It's a hit. Isn't it great? I'm so excited about it.
We're glad for you.
Yeah. But so,
and you're still active. You're still playing. I understand you play tennis.
It's not just that I'm still active. I deliberately do these things because they're important to slow the progress of Parkinson's. I play tennis. I try to play tennis singles twice a week.
Better than I could.
I take boxing lessons 3 times a week. Boxing is particularly good for Parkinson's. And I march to John Philip Sousa music. Wow. And I juggle.
I saw that. I saw the video of you juggling.
It's on Twitter. You,
how long did it take to learn how to do that?
Well, I learned when I was a kid. And I'm getting back to it now. And I count the number of times I can keep the ball in the air. So I got up to 24 times. But I made a GIF so that it looks like I'm juggling forever.
I saw that.
If you can't do it, make a GIF.
You have to start spinning those plates now. I heard you say that you were prompted to get tested from reading something in the Times.
Yeah, that's a wonderful example of communication, which, as you know, I'm obsessed with. Jane Brody wrote a column where she quoted 2 doctors, I guess they're neurologists, who found that among their patients, having dreams in which you act out the dream while you're asleep, you physically act it out, is a very often a sign before any other symptoms show up that you might have Parkinson's. And so I noticed that at least on one occasion, actually several occasions, but one example was I had a dream that I was being attacked, and I picked up a sack of potatoes and threw it at the attacker. And in actuality, I was throwing a pillow at my wife. I also fell out of bed twice in 1 week during that period. So when I read that column, I thought, I may have this, and I want to know if I got it. And I went to a doctor, and I said, I want a brain scan. And he examined me, and he said, why do you want a brain scan? You don't have anything. And I said, well, I think I might, and I want to know if I've got it, because I want to take action. I want to do something, because I've read that there are things you can do. And he called me up and said, boy, you got it.
And your reaction?
My reaction was I had to tell my family and calm them down. Because everybody tends to think, oh, my God, this is the worst thing that can happen. And it may turn out to be a terrible thing. Everybody's got a different flavor of this disease. Mm-hmm. It seems that no two people have exactly the same version of it. So I may turn out to have a terrible version of it, but I'm going to hold it off as long as I can. It's reality.
Right.
You know, you got something you have to do. For me, it's a puzzle to be solved. And I'm not going to spend all my time talking about it publicly. I talked about it once on CBS. You got an email to me right away.
I knew, get in there early.
And in a moment of weakness, I said yes. But I can't be Mr. Parkinson's. I have to do other things. But on Clear and Vivid, the podcast, I think I might deal with it on one episode, because there are a lot of communications questions about this, how you deal with your family, how you deal with the people who work with you, and that kind of thing. And how we all regard it. It would be helpful, it would be healthier for people if we didn't regard it as such a catastrophe at first, mm-hmm. right off the bat.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking with Alan Alda, who is he's got a new podcast, Clear and Vivid, out. And you say, is this going to be your last interview about this? You say you don't want to become the voice or the face of Parkinson's disease and talk about it all the time. Go on and with the rest of your life.
And I haven't even got the time to do it. However, I am going to be talking to morning television shows in Australia and the United Kingdom about the podcast in the next few weeks. So this will probably come up. I can't avoid its coming up, you know, in an ordinary interview. Because mm-hmm. I do want people to know about the podcast, but I can't show up and give speeches about it and that kind of thing. I have so many other. I'm awash with things to do.
You look great.
Thank you. Thank you.
I would have never known that you were. It's obvious you don't have an advanced case of Parkinson's.
Right. Right.
And you know you're very active and. And that's the way. And you are being proactive in saying, I need to do these things. That's an interesting point I hadn't heard before.
Well, it turns out that the sooner you do something, the better. That's why it was good to know about, and I'm glad to have helped spread the word about the acting out of dreams, which I think is also called REM sleep disorder.
Wow.
So I would like to see, and I think to some extent, judging by what I see on Twitter, there has been a response to this disclosure I made, which is helping other people focus on some of the useful facts about it.
Well, you are the best person to talk about it because you now have the best part of your life now is being a communicator.
It's so much fun for me to find out more about it and to see. And here's an example. You're right. This is an example of communication because one of the great things about good communication is if you make it personal, it sticks better.
Right.
People hear it and they internalize it because we're such social animals, I think. And so here's, instead of saying the facts are early detection is good and exercise therapy is important, instead of talking in generalities, I've told a personal story, yeah. And I think that may help.
It does help. And it helps us to communicate with you, and thank you for taking time to come in and talk about it. I'm glad I got my phone call on early.
You were pretty quick.
You answered it right away. It was great to hear it.
Well, it's because I like you, Ira.
That makes one. See, it makes one person. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thanks
and stay in touch. Alan Alda, who is host of the new podcast, Clear and Vivid. And of course, he is also head of the Alan Alda Center for Communicating Science. Thanks again, Alan. That conversation with Alan Alda was recorded back in 2018. After the break, we fast forward to 2022, when Dr. Carolyn Bertozzi won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry.
When someone is really thinking outside the box or in a very different way, we like to think of that as orthogonal thinking. So bio-orthogonal means not interacting with biology, totally separate from biology.
Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're celebrating our 33rd anniversary today with some of our listeners' favorite segments. And you know what? High on that list was this 2022 conversation with Nobel Prize-winning chemist Dr. Carolyn Bertozzi. Let's listen. Today, bio-orthogonal chemistry is a staple in biological research and a promising tool for medicine. These reactions involve two chemicals that can bond with each other, even in an environment as complicated as the human body. And they don't interfere with the normal chemical reactions in the body. Its pioneer won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry for her research. Let me bring her on now. Dr. Carolyn Bertozzi, 2022 Nobel Prize laureate and professor of chemistry at Stanford in Palo Alto, California. Congratulations and welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much. It's really wonderful to be here.
Nice to have you. Okay, let's start with the basics. What does it mean for chemistry to be bio-orthogonal? Pretty big word there.
Yes, it's a bit of a mouthful, but you can break it down into its two parts. So the word orthogonal is one that we usually use when we're trying to describe two things that don't interact with each other. When someone is really thinking outside the box or in a very different way, we like to think of that as orthogonal thinking. So bio-orthogonal means not interacting with biology, totally separate from biology. And we invented that concept because we had ideas for how such a chemistry could be useful in biology and medicine.
Give me your idea of how useful it is.
Well, it started with a very specific application in mind. And what the backstory is that I had a longstanding interest in the biology of complex carbohydrates. And people might think of that term as having to do with food that you eat. But there's a whole different world of biology of complex carbohydrates, which is that they're basically like a forest that decorates the entire surface of every cell in your body. And we wanted to be able to study those complex carbohydrates, and we wanted to image them. We wanted to be able to see them in microscopes or see them in a magnetic resonance imaging scan or a PET scan. And there was no way to see them. So the very early genesis of bio-orthogonal chemistry was as a tool to be able to study and to visualize those cell surface sugar molecules.
And why do you want to know so much about how the sugar molecules are working on the cell surface?
Well, even back in the 1990s, which is when I started this whole area of research, people knew that the structures of cell surface sugars change during diseases. And the area in which this had been studied most extensively was in cancer. So people knew that if you looked at the surface of cancer cells, the sugars had changed compared to the normal cells around them. And anytime there's a change in molecules between healthy tissue and cancerous tissue, you might be able to exploit that as a means to visualize those disease cells and to detect the disease. But the problem was, at that time, the only way to study those sugars was on cells and tissues that you took out of the body and ground up into bits and pieces and destroyed. And there was really no way to look at the sugars on the cells when they were alive and in the body. And that's what you need to do if you want to be able to detect these changes for cancer detection or cancer diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. And so how does looking at sugars connect to the idea of this orthogonal model? How did you apply it?
Well, you know, it's funny because science usually has a backstory of accidents and serendipity. And this story has an element of that. So way back when I was a postdoctoral fellow, and so this is before I was a professor, instead I was a researcher in someone else's lab at the time. And I was thinking about the sugars and frustrated that there was no way to visualize them. And other molecules like proteins and DNA and RNA, other stuff that you find in cells and in animals and humans, there were actually some really nice technologies to look at those other molecules, but there was just a gap. There was nothing for the sugars. And then I happened to go to a conference in Southampton, England, of all places, as a postdoctoral fellow, and I heard a lecture from a German biochemist named Werner Reuter. And in that lecture, he talked about the fact that you could feed cells chemically altered versions of very simple sugars. And as long as the alterations were very subtle, not too dramatic, those altered sugars would get metabolized by the cells and they would be incorporated into the cell surface complex carbohydrates. So you could actually make the cells turn into what they eat. You've heard the phrase, you are what you eat, right? And these cells actually were putting altered sugars on the surface just because they were eating the little simple precursors. And so that gave me an idea for how you could sneak a little bit of chemistry into cell surface sugars and then use the chemistry to attach probe molecules for imaging. And it was a very simple idea at the time, but there was a huge problem with the idea because you would need the simple chemistry to be what we later termed bio-orthogonal. And there really wasn't a chemistry that existed at that time that would allow you to do such a thing. So that was where the motivation came from. And if I hadn't seen that lecture by Professor Reuter, I'm not sure I would have had this idea anytime soon.
Well, how do you guarantee that your bio-orthogonal chemistry is only going to react with the one specific thing you want it to?
Well, that is the central challenge in the whole area, is to find these, you know, magical chemistries that, even though there's thousands of other chemicals in your body, that somehow they're willing to ignore all of that and yet still react with something else that's bio-orthogonal. And we spent many years engineering the chemical groups so that they would have exactly this sort of thread the needle capability. And you have to do a lot of experimentation. So when we made new functional groups, which is what we call chemical groups, well, we would test them. We would test them in cells in a dish, first and foremost. And we would do a lot of experiments to see whether they were attaching themselves unwittingly to some of the biological molecules. And if they did, we threw them in the garbage can and went back and try a different type of chemical. And once we got them to be very clean in cells, then we would test them in animals. And enough of that has now transpired over the last 25 years that we now are very confident that we have a toolkit of bio-orthogonal chemistries that are so safe that some of them are now being tested in human clinical trials. They're inside the body of human patients.
Well, that brings me to the meat of my next question, so to speak. Give me some ideas of how you might apply this chemistry.
Well, right now, the two leading applications have to do with drug delivery, right? So especially for cancer. And we all know that the types of medicines people are traditionally treated with for cancer, which we call chemotherapies, they can be really toxic and hard to handle. And the way that those medicines work is they kill cancer cells, but they also kill some of your healthy cells at the same time. And that's why people on chemo have these side effects, like losing their hair and being very nauseated, and sometimes having organ damage. And, you know, on a bad day, the drug might do more harm than good to a cancer patient. So one of the challenges is to figure out, how do you send that toxic drug to the cancer cell specifically, like a guided missile, and keep it away from all the other cells in the body? And bioorthogonal chemistry has turned out to be useful for this. And so as a case in point, there is a biotech company here in the Bay Area, outside San Francisco, that I am an advisor for. And they have a protocol to treat patients with soft tissue sarcoma. That's a particular type of cancer in bones. And the way they do this is they inject into the tumor area a material. It's a hydrogel polymer, and it's actually quite similar to the same material that's injected cosmetically for people who want filler. If you've ever heard of cosmetic fillers, there's literally a polymer that gets injected into the face where a person wants to fill a wrinkle, for example.
Yeah, we're not talking Botox here, right?
No, not Botox. This is a different substance. It's harmless. It just kind of puffs up your skin, okay? So what this company has done is they have modified that same material with a bioorthogonal chemical. And they inject that material into the tumor. And it does nothing but fill up space. It's harmless. That bioorthogonal chemical has no interaction with the human body, just sitting there. But then, the next day, they inject the chemotherapy drug systemically. They put it, you know, in the typical way, in an IV bag. So the patient sits there and they have an IV infusion of chemotherapy. But the chemotherapy is rendered harmless by attachment of another bioorthogonal chemical. And it floats throughout the body, throughout circulation, doing nothing. It's totally harmless. But when it encounters that material that was injected on the previous day, the two bioorthogonal chemicals see each other and they react. And that reaction releases the active chemotherapy right there locally in the environment of the tumor. So you get this burst of toxic drug only in the tumor and nowhere else in the body, and it kills the tumor without these toxic side effects. And they are now performing this procedure on patients in what's called a phase 1 clinical trial. So they're looking to make sure that it's safe and to figure out what are the right doses of the two components. And if everything goes well, they'll start a next phase where they look for reduction of the tumor burden and benefit to the patient.
Well, are there other drug applications or other diseases, tumors, you name it, that this might work with?
Yes, there's another group in New York that is gearing up for a clinical trial to target radioisotopes to cancers. And these are like nuclear particles that release radiation that's damaging to the tumor. Also, it's a way of basically delivering the radiation very specifically to the tumor and keeping the damage away from other tissues. And it's kind of a similar strategy. They put one molecule in first, and it's actually an antibody that's armed with a bioorthogonal chemical. And that antibody is like a heat-seeking missile, which goes to the tumor and latches onto it. And then in a second step, they add the radioactive particle, which has the other bioorthogonal partner on it. And it will then find that antibody and do the reaction. And now that radioactive particle is also concentrated in the tumor. So it's kind of a similar approach, but instead of a chemotherapeutic drug, it's a radioactive particle. And instead of a polymer that gets injected, it's an antibody that finds its way. But I think that theme is one that you'll find being tested again and again and again. And it's something you really couldn't even conceive of doing without the availability of bioorthogonal chemistries.
I've heard the work your co-Nobelist did called click chemistry. Is this kind of a click chemistry you're talking about?
Yes. You know, there are many overlapping concepts between bioorthogonal and click chemistry. And that's why I think the Nobel Foundation kind of put us together into this one prize. The click chemistry term was coined by Barry Sharpless, and he shares the prize with myself and another chemist named Morten Meldahl. Barry was interested in reactions that have the property that they're very reliable. They form products in very high yield, and they do so without interference by other functional groups on the same molecules. So you can see how that's a similar, you know, challenge to our own thinking about bioorthogonal chemistry. The big difference is that when Barry was conceiving of click chemistries, he was thinking about them as tools for the synthesis of complex molecules, which is another big challenge in the chemical sciences. And Morten Meldahl had a similar motivation. You know, both he and Barry are synthetic chemists. They like to make big, complicated molecules. And having these click chemistries can get you to those big, complicated molecules much more easily.
You know, people say chemistry is so boring, right?
People are wrong.
Well, this is a great example of that. What sort of advice would you give people coming to you, for future scientists? Would you? I'm sure you would point them in your direction, because as we say, chemistry is a lot less boring than you think it is.
That's correct. I think the misconception of chemistry being boring might be our own fault, because I think chemists teach students, and usually the first exposure is somewhere in high school. I think we teach those high school students in a kind of boring way.
You think?
I think so. I can only, and I say this
as someone who took chemistry in high school, I can tell you that's the truth.
It was true for me too, I hate to say. I took chemistry in high school, and I don't know that I hated it, but I didn't like it.
Yeah.
It was my worst subject. Yeah, it was boring, and I didn't understand. It didn't seem relevant to me or the world at all. And then I went to college, and at first I was a pre-med. And so you have to take some chemistry classes if you're destined for medical school. So I did, not because I wanted to, but because I had to. And even in freshman chemistry, I was not interested. Again, it didn't seem all that relevant or interesting to me. I'm just like you in that regard. And if I had not taken organic chemistry, I think I probably wouldn't have discovered the field as an exciting field. But organic chemistry turned things around for me. And that's when I realized that chemistry is so central in biology and biomedicine. And if you want to understand disease, you know, human disease, and figure out how to treat diseases, you really need to be a chemist. So I'm really glad that I stuck with it long enough to discover organic chemistry, because that sealed it for me. But I think if we did a better job teaching in the early stages, people wouldn't have this bias against chemistry. It's fascinating. And there's so much we don't know and so many discoveries yet to be made. The field I think of as still very young.
So now you have this huge stage as a Nobel winner. You're in the spotlight. Are there things you want to use that power or visibility to try to do that maybe you couldn't just as a chemist?
This is a really interesting question. You know, I certainly have philosophies that I would like people to think about and maybe even embrace, having to do with the diversity of scientists needing some enhancement in order for us to do the best science we can do, especially in the physical sciences like chemistry. There are many different, you know, underrepresented groups who have been historically excluded from the field and whose talent we haven't been able to avail ourselves of, which limits progress. Hopefully now people will pay attention to the importance of diversifying the chemical workforce so that we can take advantage of all the talent. That's one thing I would like to convey. And, you know, the interesting thing is lots of chemists, including myself, have been advocating for greater diversity among our ranks. But if you are awarded a Nobel Prize and your strategy for success has been to have the most diverse lab that you can have, I think that that gives, you know, some validation to the idea that diversity breeds success.
Dr. Carolyn Bertozzi is professor of chemistry at Stanford University in Palo Alto and 2022 winner of the Nobel Prize.
Thank you so much for having me.
That conversation was recorded back in 2022. After the break, we'll go way back to the last days of the dinosaurs. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, we're going back in time, way back, to explore what happened on Earth after that massive asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs. A new book traces what happened from the immediate aftermath to thousands of years later. The world changed literally overnight, if not faster. As for we humans, says the author, we wouldn't exist without the obliterating smack of cosmic rock that plowed itself into the ancient Yucatan. Wouldn't you like to know more? I would. Joining me is Riley Black, author of The Last Days of the Dinosaur, based in Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me back on.
You're quite welcome. You know, I know you have written several books, many about dinosaurs. Why did you want to focus on the last days of the dinosaur in this book?
Yeah, I realized that I hadn't really done justice to the story, to borrow that Seinfeld line. I kind of yada-yada this extinction, right? Because a big rock strikes the planet. We assume that it's, you know, going to cause a mass extinction somehow. But there have been other impacts at other times. I had nothing to do with any major extinction event. So this seemed different. And I realized I didn't know as much about it as I probably should. And the more that I started to research on this, and I mean, paleontology is my beat. I write stories about some of these new discoveries. I realized that I had the story kind of not entirely wrong, but I didn't understand how much we had learned about it.
Yeah. Well, let's begin where you just left off there. You say in your book that there have been other impacts of similar or greater scale that did not trigger biological disasters. So what was it about this impact that did?
Yeah, that's the really strange thing, because it's not as if this asteroid or if whatever this body of rock was, we're pretty sure it was some kind of asteroid, a carbonaceous chondrite, I think is the best working hypothesis right now. It wasn't just hanging out, you know, near Earth and decided to stop in. It had been traveling towards our planet for a very, very long time. And this was kind of like a galactic skill shot in a sense. Like, you know, it could have just as easily missed or come closer, hit somewhere else on the planet. But the fact that it hit at an incredible amount of speed was so very big, and it hit all this limestone. So basically these ancient fossil deposits, the ancient remnants of reefs that had existed millions of years before the impact itself, that contained all these chemical compounds that contributed to the impact winter. So when you put all these things together, the size and the speed, the angle at which it hit, the sheer force of it, all these things came together and basically the worst case scenario that nothing quite like this has ever happened before in Earth's history, and certainly not at such sort of a vulnerable moment for life on Earth. And all these things came together, not just in the first 24 hours, we had this incredible heat pulse and all this debris, but in the years following. So it really was every single way that this could have gone wrong for life on Earth, just about that's how this played out. It's really spectacular how quick and violent this was.
Yeah, so it was the perfect asteroid storm, you're saying, is what it is.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's talk about the sequence of events, and that's what you do in the book. You go through the first days, months, years, eons, thousands, million years. Let's look at the timeline on this. You write that this calamity was as immediate and horrific as a bullet wound. Explain that.
Yeah, so when we think about this mass extinction, or at least a lot of the visuals that I get or got growing up about this mass extinction, you'd see these emaciated dinosaurs wandering through this like nuclear winter kind of scenario, that they made it through the first day, but it was really the debris clouds and the cessation of photosynthesis and all these big environmental changes. But we now know that they probably didn't even make it that far, that basically all our favorite non-avian dinosaurs, T-Rex and Triceratops and Montesaurus and all those, were probably gone within about the first 24 hours. Because what happened in the minutes to hours following this impact, you had all this pulverized rock, so millions of cubic miles of rock that's been thrown up into the atmosphere that start to spread. Basically, they start to spread all over the planet. You know, and as they're coming down, each one, each little piece is creating a significant amount of friction by itself. Any one of those isn't very much, but you do enough of that, it's just so much debris and so much basically damage created by this impact, that all that friction creates an infrared pulse. It raises the air temperature all around the planet to about 500 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you ever, you know, broiled a chicken, that's about what you broil a chicken at. And T-Rex was more or less a broiled chicken within about 24 hours of this impact, that if you couldn't get underground, if you couldn't get underwater, in somewhere had some other way to block yourself from this pulse.
Wow.
You're basically out in the open. It was so hot that some forests were spontaneously catching fire based upon some of these models that geologists and paleontologists put together. So it really was incredibly extreme.
And then we had a cold period.
That's right. About 3 years of impact winter. So you had this terrible heat pulse that did most of the major initial damage. But in the years that followed, you not only had the soot from forest fires all over the planet, you not only had all the dust and debris thrown up by the impact itself, but all these sulfur-based compounds that we know from observations during our own history are really good at reflecting back sunlight. So it's estimated that the sunlight reaching the Earth was reduced by at least about 20%, and that was enough to curtail, if not stop, photosynthesis over much of the planet. And if you take out plants as the basis of our ecosystem, as the basis of our oceans, as the basis of how we get our oxygen, it's something over those 3 years that not only temperatures dropped, but ecosystems almost entirely collapsed. And those survivors during those 3 years had to get by on scraps.
There was one factor that made this extinction not as bad as it could be, you write, and that's a very unlikely source. I'm talking about volcanoes. Can you explain this?
Yeah, so in the past, we've had at least 5 mass extinctions so far. We may be entering a 6th, but most of those 5, or at least a significant number of them, prior to this asteroid impact at the end of the Cretaceous, were caused by volcanic activity. And in particular, prior to the asteroid impact and after the asteroid impact 66 million years ago, it had incredible outpourings in what's called the Deccan Traps in what's now India. Just, you know, thousands of miles just covered by molten rock and all the greenhouse gases that are being spewed into the atmosphere as part of it. And those greenhouse gases, in fact, counteracted some of the effects of impact winter. This is not what we think of when we think of volcanic eruptions like this. We often think about them in terms of causing extinctions, but in this case, it kept the impact winter from being as bad as it otherwise could have been. It raised temperatures just enough to allow some forms of life to be able to survive when otherwise they would have gone extinct in the chill of that impact winter. So even though those volcanic eruptions were previously considered to be a contender for this extinction, it turns out that they kind of mitigated the effects of the asteroid impact and kind of came to the rescue for at least some forms of life.
Yeah, that is really something new that we haven't heard before, because we've heard of research that says the dinosaurs were already weakened by natural forces and possibly volcanoes. They were on their way out, and the asteroid just provided that final push. But are you saying that's not true?
That's right. It seems to be the opposite case, that volcanic eruptions actually assisted some of these surviving animals. Most of the non-avian dinosaurs, if not all of them, were already gone by the time, you know, this counteracting force would have come into play. But that's the other part of this, is that so much of what we understand about this extinction comes from Western North America. It comes from the Hell Creek Formation, the overlying rock layers in Montana and the Dakotas. There's so much that we don't know. So the decline that paleontologists previously thought they saw, it's because there are fewer rocks from the relevant time period. So just as an absolute level, we have less dinosaur diversity because there aren't as many rocks from the very end of the Cretaceous that actually preserved them as compared to 10 million years before. So we're really learning, in a sense, how much we didn't previously know about this mass extinction and how it played out.
And how long did it take for plant life to come back?
There's a seed bank, or there was a seed bank in the soil. So a lot of plants, you know, they spread their seeds, they spread nuts, they spread their fruits as far as they possibly can. And some of those already existed in the soil and would have been shielded by some of the heat effects. It really only takes about a couple of inches of soil to really shield what's in the soil from the effects of things like forest fires. We know from modern day forest fires, they get about as hot as that infrared pulse, that it doesn't take all that much. So that seed layer was there. It actually allowed beaked birds to survive. That's why we have dinosaurs around us now, is because beaked birds were able to subsist on the seeds and nuts that still existed. But it took at least about 100,000 years before you started to see vegetation make a real recovery. You have what's called a fern spike, where we see fossil ferns and their spores everywhere in the fossil record around this time. And that's because ferns are what we call disaster taxa. They're really good at coming into spaces that have been disturbed, that have been disrupted. And they're kind of the first initial signs that life is beginning to recover. And then about a million years after impact, that's when you start to have these thick, dense forests starting to grow up, that you have the rise of flowering plants and angiosperms rather than conifers. So it took about a million years before anything recognizable as a forest started to reestablish itself.
Very interesting. And one of the interesting topics you talk about in the book is the evolution of the bird life following the impact. In fact, I found it fascinating to learn that it was the evolution of a beak and not the teeth of the dinosaur birds.
Yeah, that's right.
That allowed these birds to survive. What's there about a beak that nature likes?
Yeah, we've had beaks evolve multiple times, over and over again. In the case of dinosaurs, why beaked birds were able to survive, if you think about what birds and bird-like dinosaurs were doing prior to the impact, you had basically things like Velociraptor covered in feathers, very sharp teeth.
Right.
We had toothed birds that were able to eat insects and little lizards and things like that. And then you had beaked birds that primarily ate seeds, nuts, plant material. They were already adapted to this kind of diet. They probably already had things like, a gizzard or ways to grind up that plant food. So they, in a sense, were pre-adapted to life after impact. Whereas all those carnivorous species, there's nothing for them to eat because there are no more plants. There, therefore, are no more insects. There are very few small little critters for them to eat. So basically, if you were a carnivore trying to survive through this impact winter, it is much, much more difficult. Whereas beaked birds, they were already adapted to eating things that had survived. And that's why they're able to hang on.
Interesting. So what else was different about plant and animal life post-impact?
You see forests grow a lot denser. If you think about forests and habitats in the age of the dinosaurs, basically in that end Cretaceous heyday, it would have looked somewhat similar to areas in like Eastern Africa today. So more conifers than flowering plants. There's certainly no grasses, but that kind of open habitat and open woodland, because many dinosaurs were big. Where they walked, where they pushed over trees, where they fed, this all influenced the ecosystem. It shaped it around them. So you're going to have dinosaur-sized holes basically through any ecology that you're looking at. But once they were gone, once you don't have things like Triceratops mowing down vegetation or pushing over trees anymore, forests could grow a lot denser, they could grow a lot closer together, and they could grow tall. And that provided a multi-tiered ecosystem for their survivors. Whether you were a bird or a mammal or an insect, life could be different at the canopy than on the trunk of the tree, than at the surface of the soil or down below that soil. So it had all these different new opportunities for evolution and pioneering new niches open up.
Right. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios. Talking to Riley Black, author of The Last Days of the Dinosaurs. Really interesting. You, as I said in the opening, I read a portion of your book where you said, we, meaning humans, we wouldn't exist without the obliterating smack of cosmic rock. Why is that?
There's no reason to think that the age of dinosaurs would have stopped without this. I mean, in a sense, we still are because birds are still here, but the kind of dinosaurs that we think about and see in the movies all the time, they would still be here. If you think about 66 million years, there's a very long time. But if you were to start from the day before impact, so, T-Rex and Triceratops are still doing fine, project that backwards 66 million years further into the Cretaceous, dinosaurs are still around. They're doing fine. Like, basically, there's more time between Stegosaurus and T-Rex than there's been since T-Rex went extinct. So dinosaurs were the dominant vertebrates on land. They're the most prominent vertebrates on land for so very long. And they'd survived so many different changes between the continents moving around, volcanic eruptions, climate changes, sea level changes. They would have made it through. It took something really unexpected and unprecedented to really change up life and what it was. And our ancestors could have very well gone extinct in this very same extinction. It's one of the things that blows my mind, honestly, is that there were primates around during the last day of the Cretaceous. This little animal called Purgatorius is the earliest known primate. And it was able to survive where the big and terrible dinosaurs weren't. So it's not just that we evolved as a result of this extinction, but our ancestors, our primate ancestors, actually eked right through it.
That is cool. Are there other things we can see now that are direct remains of this extinction?
You can look almost anywhere. Basically, whether it's seeing all the flowering plants and their pollinators, that's something that those interactions and those kinds of plants were around before impact, but they're much more prominent now. Or things like beans. I loved a good taco. I like to put refried beans on it sometimes. Beans only came about because legumes evolved about a million years after impact, that plant life got this reinvigorated kind of evolutionary pulse after the impact, and basically plants like legumes that are rich in protein are part of that as well. So whether it's just our own existence or what we eat or the sort of vegetation we see around us, there are so many little hallmarks that we can draw back to this mass extinction.
Who knew how important beans were? As you say, Riley, you've written a lot about dinosaurs and written many books. What surprised you the most about writing this book in your research?
I felt like so much of it was a surprise because I had so many assumptions going into it. I think what really struck me was how the way the world recovered after impact, how relatively quick that was. I mean, a million years is a long time, but to think that prior to the mass extinction, the largest mammals that we know about were about the size of a house cat. And then a million years later, the largest mammals that we know about were about the size of a German shepherd. And that's quite a bit bigger. And we're starting to understand so much of how and why they evolved and the pattern of their evolution. There's a paper that just came out. I wish I could have included it in the book, but it's still fascinating to me about how mammals were getting big so quickly that their brains pretty much remained at the same size as they had been post-impact, so that you have much bigger bodied mammals, but their brains are about the same size. And it wasn't until about another 10 million years or so after that, after impact, that you start to see a lot more sort of changes to the prefrontal cortex and changes in behaviors and interactions and things like that. So that life really raced to fill in the voids that were left by this mass extinction in such a way that it was a really formative and interesting time for evolution in general. Like, it wasn't a sense of progress or mammals, you know, picking up the torch where dinosaurs had left it, but it was something entirely new happening. And seeing and understanding some of these interactions that we never got to view before, so much of this research has come out in the past 5 or 10 years. You know, even the last year, we've made a lot of new discoveries. So this is rapidly changing and giving us this view, this timeline that we never really had before.
That conversation with Riley Black, recorded in 2022. You folks chose it as one of your favorite segments from our 33 years. And if you didn't hear your pick today, don't worry. We've got a few more favorites to pull out of our archives during the December holidays. That's about it for this hour. Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week and every week, including
John Dankosky,
Annie Nero,
Jason Rosenberg,
Rasha Aridi,
Shoshana Buxbaum.
Thank you, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And of course, if you missed any part of the program or would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. Before we go this week, I want to thank all of you who have been a part of our family for these 33 years. We would not be here without you. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We hope you had a peaceful and happy Thanksgiving, and we're glad you're with us today, because here at Science Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, is our own kind of holiday tradition. Highlights from the year's Ig Nobel Awards ceremony. The awards are handed out each year by the editors of the science humor magazine, The Annals of Improbable Research, for work in science that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. It's stuff that might make you say, I wonder. Shower thoughts, some people call them. This year's celebration is the 34th First Annual Awards, and for the first time in several years, the ceremony was held post-COVID in person in a theater on the MIT campus. Glad to see them all back in the flesh. This year's ceremonies featured a mini opera about Murphy's Law. You know, if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. And prizes handed out by genuine, real Nobel laureates. Just to explain a few things before we start. There are a few traditions at the ceremonies, like the traditional welcome, welcome, and goodbye, goodbye speeches. There's an official who will sound an alarm if things threaten to get too raunchy. And then there's Miss Sweetie Poo, a little girl who starts to whine whenever the speakers go on too long. And you know what? Sometimes the speakers try to bribe her, but she always wins in the end. So here's our post-Thanksgiving tradition as we take you back to earlier this year at MIT, where the dignitaries and the ignitaries are taking the stage.
Welcome. Welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, and variations thereupon,
welcome to the 31st 4th annual Ig Nobel. Oh, sorry. Welcome to the 34th 1st annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. Tonight, we are going to award the 2024 Ig Nobel Prizes. Soon, we will welcome our most special guests, the new Ig Nobel Prize winners. This year's winners represent many countries and exactly one planet. Now, ladies and gentlemen, children and elders, literati, glitterati, pseudo-intellectuals, quasi-pseudo-intellectuals, pseudo-quasi-intellectuals, smoots, bots, bacteria, wilbies, has-beens, victims of Murphy's Law, and the rest of you, may I introduce our master of ceremonies, the editor of the Annals of Improbable Research, Chief Airhead Mark Abrams.
Tonight, we honor some remarkable individuals and groups. Every Ig Nobel Prize winner has done something that first makes people laugh and then makes them think. The Ig Nobel Prize ceremony is produced by the magazine, our magazine, the Annals of Improbable Research. And it's produced in collaboration with the MIT Press. The editors of the Annals of Improbable Research have chosen a theme for this year's Ig Nobel Prize ceremony. That theme is Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law is the idea that if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. There are many other ways to phrase that. Many of them are wrong. Tonight, there are 10 prizes. The achievements speak for themselves. Yet, we will speak of them. The prizes will be presented to the winners by Nobel laureates. Please welcome the Nobel laureates who will hand out the prizes. Let's give each of them a hand. 2007 Nobel laureate in economics, Eric Maskin. 2009 Nobel laureate in economics, Esther Duflo. 2009 Nobel laureate in economics, Abhijit Banerjee. 1997 Nobel laureate in economics, Robert Merton. 2023 Nobel laureate in chemistry, Mungi Bawendi. 1990 Nobel laureate in physics, Jerome Friedman, is again unable to join us on this particular night. He joins us, though, as usual, via the magic of recorded video.
Congratulations. I hope you are enjoying this as much as I am.
And now let's get it over with, ladies, gentlemen, the awarding of the 2024 Ig Nobel Prizes. We are, as you've heard several times, giving out 10 prizes. The winners do come from many nations. They have all earned their prizes. Karen, tell them what they've won.
This year's winners each get an Ig Nobel Prize. And they get a piece of paper. This piece of paper says they've won an Ig Nobel Prize. I have it in here somewhere. Ladies and gentlemen, now I will show you the coveted Ig Nobel Prize. This year's Ig Nobel Prize is a transparent box. The box contains historic items about the history of Murphy's Law. Some of these items are missing. And the box is almost impossible to open.
The Peace Prize. The winner is from the USA. The Ig Nobel Peace Prize is awarded to the late B.F. Skinner for experiments to see the feasibility of housing live pigeons inside missiles to guide the flight paths of the missiles. Accepting on behalf of B.F. Skinner, here is his daughter, Julie Skinner Vargas.
On behalf of my father, B.F. Skinner, I want to thank you for finally acknowledging his most important contribution. People know him only for discovering operant conditioning, schedules of reinforcement, and for books like Walden 2, Verbal Behavior, Beyond Freedom D, and more. Even the B.F. Skinner Foundation fails to put a missile on its hat. So thank you for finally putting the record straight.
The Anatomy Prize.
Stay together. Can everyone hear me? This is room 10250. It's one of the most famous rooms here at MIT. It's used for all sorts of lectures. Nobel laureates have lectured here. MIT presidents have been introduced to the world here. Fortunately, nothing that important seems to be going on right now. Now, I'm told that if you want to take a nap during your class, the best place to do it is back there in row P. Yes, thank you. Thank you. And if you were ever to be here when it was empty, which is very unusual because it's used about 90% of the time, but if you were ever to be here when it was empty, I'd suggest you look under your seat because it's been said that more than one MIT student leaves their slide rule behind when they graduate. Anyway, our next stop is the Infinite Corridor, so we don't want to linger.
The Anatomy Prize. The Ig Nobel Anatomy Prize is awarded to Marjolaine Willems, Quentin Henoch, Sarah Tanon Delara, Nicholas Kogan, Vincent Fleury, Romy Reyes-Guerre, Juan Jose Cortez Santander, Roberto Requena, Julian Sterneman, and Roman Hossein Consare for studying whether the hair on the heads of most people in the Northern Hemisphere swirls in the same direction, clockwise or counterclockwise, as hair on the heads of most people in the Southern Hemisphere.
We warmly thank the scientific committee to have chosen our publication about genetic determinism and hemisphere influence on hair wall direction. So to make a long story short, it began with the observation of my own twin identical daughters. When they just were born, I observed the same direction of the wall, but one left-sided and the other one right-sided. So I decided to investigate, and I called my friend Hossein.
Yes, so we found interesting results on twins, and then we decided to check this quite a strange hypothesis, whether they would turn in opposite direction in the northern and southern hemisphere. So then we started working with colleagues from Chile, and we realized that, in fact, they do. It's nearly clockwise for everyone.
Next
year for the rest.
We have a demonstration. Everyone here in this room, would you please look at the head of the person directly in front of you, who is slightly below your level, then please, by raising your own arm in the air and twirling it, indicate in which direction, clockwise. Oh, if you're wearing a hat, would you please remove it? Please indicate by raising your arm in the air and twirling it which direction, clockwise or counterclockwise, the hair is swirling.
We have to take a break, but we'll be right back with more from the Ig Nobel Awards in just a moment. You're listening to Science Friday from WNYC Studios. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. In case you're just joining us, we're playing highlights from this year's Ig Nobel Awards ceremony. Research that first makes you laugh and then makes you think. It was recorded in September of this year on the MIT campus. Here's Ig Nobel Master of Ceremonies again, Mark Abrams.
The Botany Prize. The winners are from Germany, Brazil, and the USA. The Ig Nobel Botany Prize is awarded to Jacob White and Felipe Yamashita for finding evidence that some real plants imitate the shapes of neighboring artificial plastic plants.
Thank you. I would like to thank the organization and also the Stiftung Zukunft Jetzt for funding our research. And as this research was based on a plant who can mimic the leaf of other plants, and we just use a plastic leaf, and this plant mimic the plastic leaf. And how they do that? Our hypothesis is this Bokila plant have some sort of eye. They can see what's going around. And how they do that, we have no idea. And we need to continue studying on this plant. But to study on this, I need a position. So I just finished my PhD, and I need a job now. Thank you. And I need a job to continue this research. Thank you.
Thank you. Now get set for the 24/7 lectures. We've invited several of the world's top thinkers to tell us very briefly what they are thinking about. Each 24/7 lecturer will explain their subject twice. First, a complete technical description in 24 seconds. And then, after a brief pause, a clear summary that anyone can understand in 7 words. The first 24/7 lecture will be delivered by economist and Nobel laureate Esther Duflo. Her topic is climate injustice. First, a complete technical description of the subject in 24 seconds. On your mark, get set, go.
Taking into account our full carbon footprint, an American in the top decile of the income distribution emits 120 times as much CO2e as an African in the bottom half. However, extrapolating from the marginal impact of past weather realizations, researchers estimate that higher temperature could lead to at least 6 million extra annual deaths by 2100, concentrated in poor countries, which have both hotter...
And now, a clear summary that anyone can understand in 7 words. On your mark, get set, go.
The rich consume, heat kills the poor.
The next 24/7 lecture will be delivered by ornithologist, Ig Nobel Prize winner, and Natural History Museum director, Case Mulliker. His topic, Murphy's Law and ducks. First, a complete technical description of the subject in 24 seconds. On your mark, get set, go.
The 130 species of ducks are spread worldwide in wet habitats. In a duck's life, anything can go wrong, but ducks are resilient. They've evolved to handle predators and harsh conditions, aggressive mating, and even human impact. Their numbers and diversity show that while things do go wrong, they're built and behave to survive, ensuring their presence in a changing world.
And now, a clear summary that anyone can understand in 7 words. On your mark, get set, go.
Ducks prove that nature overcomes Murphy's Law.
The Medicine Prize. The winners are from Switzerland, Germany, and Belgium. The Ig Nobel Medicine Prize is awarded to Levin Schenk, Tamine Fede, and Christian Buchel for demonstrating that fake medicine that causes painful side effects can be more effective than fake medicine that does not cause painful side effects. The prize will be presented by Nobel laureate Esther Duflo.
Well, thank you very much for this prize. It's a great honor, of course. Very happy to be here. So we actually investigated if side effects and how they actually can improve treatments. And although this sounds very counterintuitive, in some cases, previous research on placebo effects actually suggests that this is the case. So we investigated it, and we found that this is the case, that non-painful side effects can actually lead to a bigger pain reduction. And yeah, if you're interested in the details, I have to refer you to the paper. Thank you.
The Physics Prize. The winner is from the USA. The Ig Nobel Physics Prize is awarded to Jimmy Liao for demonstrating and explaining the swimming abilities of a dead trout. The prize is presented by Nobel laureate Mugi Oendi.
I discovered that a live fish moves more than a dead fish. But not by much. Not by much. A dead trout towed behind a stick also flaps its tail to the beat of the current like a live fish surfing on swirling eddies, recapturing the energy in its environment. A dead fish does live fish things, using its body like a sailboat to tack upwind, its torso undulating, acting as a lift-producing sail and a stabilizing keel at the same time. Fluids flap flexible fish forward from forces and feedback. The water swims the fish. A flaccid trout ignited my career, and I'll forever be grateful. Thank you, Ig Nobel, for not ignoring the fun in fundamental science. Viva la fish!
The Physiology Prize. The winners are from Japan and the USA. The Ig Nobel Physiology Prize is awarded to Ryo Okabe, Toyofumi Chen Yoshikawa, Yosuke Yoniyama, Yuhei Yokoyama, Satona Tanaka, Akihiko Yoshihiko, pardon me, Akihiko Yoshizawa, Wendy Thompson, Gokul Kanan, Aiji Kobayashi, Hiroshi Date, and Takanori Takebe for discovering that many mammals are capable of breathing through their anus. prize is presented to them by Nobel laureate Robert Merton.
First and foremost, thank you so much for believing the potential of anus for breathing potential. So, in Japan, we have a very interesting creature called loaches that has the capacity to suck up oxygen from the bats. So why we can't do that? So that was the question we started. So let me show how it works with this, you know, extraordinary colleagues. So we start from, you know, making oxygenated liquids and then preparing that beforehand. Then, you know, this, you know, very talented professors in the surgery in prominent university in Japan, these are full professors, by the way, and operating every day, but he just, you know, helping to, you know, pig model first and try to inject. Thank you so much. So as if loaches, they are injecting lots of bubbles in the butts, and they eventually pump it up, enjoying the extraordinary capacity to suck up the oxygen, eventually leading to improvements of respiratory failure conditions. Okay? I'm so sorry. Now we survive. We started clinical trial. Any volunteers are welcome. Thank you so much.
It's time for the next 24/7 lectures. This 24/7 lecture will be delivered by the permanent acting interim executive director of MoBA, the Museum of Bad Art, Louise Riley Sacco. Her topic, bad art. First, a complete technical description of the subject in 24 seconds. On your mark, get set, go.
Museum quality bad art is first of all art created by someone seriously attempting to make an artistic statement but has gone horribly awry in concept or execution. Poor technique is not sufficient unless the lack of drawing ability, perspective, or sense of color results in a compelling image. Many works contain over-the-top imagery whether or not the artist's intent is decipherable by the artist or the audience.
And now, a clear summary that anyone can understand in 7 words. On your mark, get set, go.
It's art too bad to be ignored.
The next 24/7 lecture will be delivered by economist and Nobel laureate Eric Maskin. His topic, Murphy's Law and Economics. First, a complete technical description of the subject in 24 seconds. On your mark, get set, go.
In the pandemic, the government sent checks to low-income individuals. This had the dual purpose of tiding the neediest people over and propping up demand to avoid a downward recessionary spiral. Unfortunately, a perfect storm of broken supply chains meant that demand exceeded supply, causing notable inflation. In other words, if you conduct fiscal policy before your chickens have hatched, you might end up with egg on your face.
And now a clear summary that anyone can understand in 7 words. On your mark, get set, go.
The fiscal stimulus won't cause inflation. Oops.
The final 24/7 lecture will be delivered by rock star and human curtain rod, Amanda Palmer. Her topic, Murphy's Law and musical performance. First, a complete technical description of the subject in 24 seconds. On your mark, get set, go.
You're a musician, so don't throw me under the bus, okay?
The one time you decide to select the two-leg Helicheap Iceland Air flight from Boston to London to kick off a tour will coincide with the exact afternoon that the infamous ash cloud volcano erupts, thereby grounding your flight in Reykjavik and trapping you in Iceland. The decision to book a tiny, unnecessary gig in Christchurch, New Zealand will coincide with the exact afternoon that the Christchurch earthquake kills almost 200 people, destroying the venue that you were meant to be performing in 5 hours later, grounding your flight and trapping you in northern New Zealand. I got two-thirds in.
Clear summary that anyone can understand in 7 words. On your mark, get set, go.
If it's all going well, just wait.
A public service announcement. Did anyone lose an Ig Nobel Prize and a $10 trillion bill here?
In this year's Ig Nobel Mini Opera, the International Murphy's Law Song Competition Contest Opera, about a competition to see who can perform the most Murphy-esque song about Murphy's Law. And of course, during the opera, things went wrong. Here's a taste of the opera.
We need to pass a law of imperfection, a law that will give people some protection to ease the suffering and vile sensation that comes from fairness, yes, and from frustration. With everything that can and will go wrong, we all know, yes, we know it will go wrong. We need a law requiring punishment or firing for whenever someone is successful, because it is distressful for the rest of us to see the wicked cruelty and the unfairness when they succeed while my life is a mess. We must imprison them, they are deserving, and when they fail to fail, it is unnerving. If they think that the bad times are behind them, the legal system really must remind them. We must succeed in making people fail. If they should fail to fail, send them to jail. We must succeed in this. We will not let a single, single, single thing go right. So whenever anything goes right, we must require that it goes wrong. We need to pass a law of imperfection to give my, our grievances some real protection.
Coming up, more highlights from this year's 34th First Annual Ig Nobel Awards. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And we now return you to highlights from this year's Ig Nobel Awards ceremony. The awards are presented by the editors of the science humor magazine Annals of Improbable Research. And you can find out more about them at improbable.com. Here's Master of Ceremonies Mark Abrams with more of the awards.
The second paper airplane deluge is about to commence.
Please prepare your paper airplanes for the second paper airplane deluge. But remember, safety first. Throw your paper airplanes only at the designated target. Prepare your airplanes for launch.
The Probability Prize.
The winners are from the Netherlands, Switzerland, Belgium, France, Germany, Hungary, and the Czech Republic. The Ig Nobel Probability Prize is awarded to František Bartoš, Erik-Jan Wagenmacher, Alexandra Sarfoglu, Hendrik Godman, and many colleagues for showing both in theory and by 350,757 experiments that when you flip a coin, it tends to land on the same side as it started. Prize will be presented by Nobel laureate Asha Banerjee.
So we flip coins over 350,000 times, which means 650 hours of constant coin flipping, or about 81 work days. It might seem ridiculous at first, and perhaps it was.
We wanted to test a prediction from Diaconis, Holmes, and Montgomery, who argued that when people flip coins, the coins wobble in the air. Because of this wobble, coins presumably tend to land on the same side they started. But the effect is very small, possibly only 1%.
We found compelling evidence for the effect. Also, some people show effects larger than others. Finally, there seems to be learning effects, and the more coins you flip, the less biased you become.
So we would encourage everybody to pick up this fascinating line of research and maybe attempt a replication of our experiment as well. Good luck.
We have a demonstration. And we ask for a volunteer from the audience to do this demonstration. We will give you a coin, some paper, and a pencil. And then you will replicate the experiment rapidly the full number of times. If you would like to volunteer, just raise your arm, please. Okay. All right. Thank you. When the ceremony ends, if you have not finished doing the full number of experiments, you can remain here in the lecture hall for as many months as you need. The Demography Prize. The winner is from Australia and the UK. The Ig Nobel Demography Prize is awarded to Saul Justin Newman for detective work to discover that many of the people famous for having the longest lives lived in places that had lousy birth and death record keeping. Prize is presented by Nobel laureate Luigi Bolendi.
Okay. I was working away in my little lab, undisturbed by bunkum and woo, when I was told the way not to get old was the Blue Zone's lifestyle breakthrough. At a stroke of a pen, they had solved medicine and shown how geriatrics keep breathing. Long living, they said, in the abstract I read, had as a secret of heavy inbreeding. And when that didn't sell, they thought grandly, well, we shall play out the long game in sales. And went searching about for a secret to tout as a way to outlive all the whales. But the secrets fell over like a lover in clover when I checked the government books. The Blue Zones are poor, the records no more. The 100-year-olds are all crooks. So the secret, it seems, to live out your dreams and make sure you keep living, not dying, is to move where birth certificates are rare. Teach your kids pension fraud and start lying. And I'd like to thank my mom, my dad. I'd like to thank all the old people who are collecting the pension while they're dead. It's really excellent work. I'd like to thank the world's oldest man for having three birthdays. I'd like to thank
Please the... stop.
Okay.
Stop. I'm bored. Please stop.
The Chemistry Prize. The winners are from the Netherlands and France. The Ig Nobel Chemistry Prize is awarded to Hess Heremans, Antoine Dublay, Daniel Bonn, and Sander Votersen for using chromatography to separate drunk and sober worms. Prize is presented to them by Nobel laureate Eric Maskin.
So if you show a long, slender, wiggly object to a chemist, he will tell you it's a polymer. But if you show the same thing to a biologist, he will tell you it's a worm that moves because it's looking for food. The naive question we asked is what the actual difference between the two systems is.
And to answer this question, we said, let's do worm chromatography. So we made the worms flow through a maze, which you see there. But before doing that, we made half of them drunk, inactive, and we painted them blue. So now we're going to reproduce the experiment on stage. It was a rafting race between a sober red worm and a drunk blue worm.
Okay, get ready. Set. Go!
And the winner is Sober Worm!
This is the 10th and final prize, the... I said the already. Mind if I say it again? The biology prize. The winners are from the USA. The Ig Nobel Biology Prize is awarded to the late Fordus Ely and the late William E. Peterson for exploding a paper bag next to a cat that's standing on the back of a cow to explore how and when cows spew their milk. Here to accept the prize on behalf of the winners are the daughter and grandson of Fordus Ely, Matt Wells and Jane Wells. The prize is presented to them by Nobel laureate Esther Duflo.
Go ahead and say thank you. Oh, go ahead. An excerpt from this work. It was thought that there might be a difference in the response of the two halves of the udder as measured by the rate of ejection of milk if the cow was severely frightened. Accordingly, the cow was systematically frightened as the mechanical milker was attached. Frightening at first consisted in placing a cat on the cow's back and exploding paper bags every 10 seconds for 2 minutes. Later, the cat was dispensed with as unnecessary.
We have a demonstration. For which we ask the five Nobel laureates to assist us. Would the minor domos please bring out the cow, the cat, and some paper bags? Thank you. As you leave the lecture hall, in about 2 minutes, possibly, please help us tidy up. There are some stray paper airplanes, and if you gather them, perhaps you'd like to bring one of those stray paper airplanes to an Ig Nobel Prize winner and get an autograph, transforming it into a historic item of some sort. Now, Barry Duncan will give the traditional Ig Nobel goodbye speech.
Goodbye. Goodbye.
Thank you for joining us at the 34th First Annual Ig Nobel Prize Ceremony. We estimate that next year's ceremony will be the 35th First Annual Ig Nobel Prize Ceremony. Now, on behalf of Improbable Research and the MIT Press and everyone here, please remember this final thought. If you didn't win an Ig Nobel Prize tonight, and especially if you did, better luck next year. Thank you.
That about wraps it up for us. Thanks to Mark Abrams and everybody at the Annals of Improbable Research. You can find out more about them at improbable.com. We're going to leave you with a selection from this year's Ig Nobel Mini Opera entitled The International Murphy's Law Song Competition Contest Opera.
Day begins great, A-okay, mate. A happy laughter. But just wait, mate. Your luck will mutate. It's your fate, mate. It's Murphy's Law. First the day breaks, then your phone breaks, then your car's brakes start to fail. Then some jerk makes you get headaches. Jerk. Will these bad breaks make you quail? Then some old schmuck screws with your lock, and your coffee fails to perk. Then you get struck by a dump truck. Is it just luck? Just some quirk? More than one time in your lifetime, you smelled solid, sweet success. But so often, it goes soft then. It becomes a crappy mess. You've worked so hard, always on guard, fending off each fatal flaw. But it's no good, no way you could have withstood.
Murphy's Law.
Well, 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 well.
One more thing before we go. The end of the year is almost here, and we need your help to recap the best science stories from 2024. Tell us your favorite science news stories or discovery from this year. Your submission might even be featured in our recap. Share your thoughts and find out how you can attend our New York City event on December 6th, all on our website, sciencefriday.com/science2024. If you missed any part of the program or you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or point your device to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can join us on social media and check out all our great newsletters, too. If you want to reach us the old-fashioned way, yes, our email address, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow.